As the holidays creep closer, the days are getting busier, routines are being thrown off by parties, endless to-dos, and that's why I reached for Tempo this year. I really liked how on their website, they ask you your goals and let me pick the multiple that I have, right? I want meals to be protein-packed, 30 grams of protein, carb-conscious, fiber-rich, right? And they had tons of choices for me. These are real meals already cooked and ready in minutes and actually good for you, helping me stay balanced while enjoying the celebrations. So what is Tempo? It's going to deliver fresh, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals to your door. They rotate about 20 new recipes every single week. So Tempo will keep things exciting, but also help us stay consistent with healthy habits. Fun fact, Tempo is even the official partner of the 2025 CrossFit Games. So really kind of saying that these meals are built to support optimal nutrition and performance. And for a limited time, Tempo is offering Corey and listeners 60% off your first box. So go to tempomeals.com/Coriam. That's tempomeals.com/Coriam for 60% off your first box. tempomeals.com/Coriam. Rules and restrictions may apply. And with that, let's get back to the episode. At Coriam, we're all about the real things that make life in healthcare a little easier, and scrubs can be one of them. I'm still amazed at all my colleagues who look so put together when they wear FIGS, and it's awesome. FIGS scrubs are built for people like us, doctors, residents, students, who are on their feet most of the day and need gear that actually works. They're lightweight, stretchy, breathable, full of small functional details that matter, right? Tons of pockets, zippers that don't snag, antimicrobial fabric. The fit is clean and modern and still very practical, and that's why I've become a convert. And with the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself with some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because FIGS just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. So if you want to check them out, FIGS is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with a code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
This is to a large extent in your control, and you should feel empowered to treat this with lifestyle adjustments. And, you know, everyone's genetics are a little bit different. And so some people have different thresholds for what you can get away with and what you can't and all of those things. And life isn't fair. But for patients, when the triglycerides are really high, to me, it's like a call to action. And if there's ever kind of a siren call for you should take control of your own health, a very high triglyceride level, it's just like the biggest call to action that you could possibly have from a lipid perspective. That's not a heart attack. And for some reason, the high triglyceride levels to me is the thing that patients actually respond to in a way that they don't respond to crazy high LDL levels.
That's Dr. Greg Katz, a cardiologist at NYU. Welcome to the Core IM Thigh Pearls podcast, bringing you high yield evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Shroy Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
Hi, I'm Jimin Hwang, Chief Resident at UT Southwestern.
And I'm Ananya Garai, a PGY3 internal medicine resident, also at UT Southwestern.
Awesome. And we are talking about severe hypertriglyceridemia today. This episode was made possible by an independent medical education grant from the National Triglyceride Association. And I've got to say, I think what I didn't expect before going into this research and interviews that we did for the episode is how much I just learned about triglycerides in general. And I think I've told countless family members about the various teaching points. I think it's something that triglycerides are part of the lipid panel that I don't think doctors intentionally ignore, but it's just kind of this extra thing. And then there's also so much focus on the LDL. And I think a lot of our patients, though, are really interested on triglycerides. And so I think to set up our learning and to make sure we're getting the most out of it, I sat down with one of my colleagues, the wonderful Dr. Adam Strauss. He told me about a memorable case he had that's going to help us walk us through our pearls today.
Yeah, so this was a 59-year-old gentleman with a history of depression, alcohol dependence, and insomnia. And he'd actually had a primary care visit a few days earlier, at which time a lipid panel was checked just for routine monitoring. And then he comes in 5 days after his appointment, after having had an alcohol binge with triglycerides of about 1600 and abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting, at which time he was found to have acute pancreatitis. And then from the emergency room, he was initially admitted to the ICU, where he was treated with an insulin drip and had improving symptoms and improving triglyceride level down to 388, And then upon leaving the ICU, was started on a fibrate as well.
Oh, man, I have so many questions. But of course, I think the first thing as an internist is wondering, could we have prevented this awful complication of elevated triglycerides? Actually, I dug back into this patient's chart, and a few days prior, this person, as Adam had mentioned, had gone to their primary care doctor, and the lipid panel had a triglyceride that came back around 488, so like close to that 500 number, and just hadn't been followed up on at that time. And so in thinking about could we have prevented it, we sat down with Dr. Seth Baum. He's a preventive cardiologist, a clinical lipidologist, and a chief medical officer at Flourish Research and the past president of the American Society for Preventive Cardiology. And he had some really good teaching points on this.
Lipoprotein lipase is what hydrolyzes the triglycerides. And lipoprotein lipase is saturated at a triglyceride level of about 500 or 600. But what that means is, if you have a patient sitting around with a triglyceride of 400, 500, 600, and the patient goes out and eats a terrible meal, within minutes, the triglyceride can be, you know, well over 1,000. So the risk of pancreatitis will increase as the triglycerides increase.
Wow, I did not realize how quickly triglycerides can vary just in a few hours of eating French fries or a burger. And that point really stuck with me since learning about it.
Yeah, and the other really big teaching point is about lipoprotein lipase. Lipoprotein lipase breaks down triglycerides and saturates at levels around 500. And when the triglycerides increases above that 500 threshold, in the most simplest sense, you get all this badness in the blood, like chylomicrons, creating a lot of complications.
And so hopefully as a takeaway, none of us feel comfortable if that triglyceride is less than 500, right? We should have alarm bells for multiple reasons that we'll go over. But one of them being that just one fatty meal can make that triglyceride shoot up 30, 50%, let alone an alcohol binge on top of it.
One of the theories is that there are such large particles that they can't make it through the small vessels in the pancreas. They get lodged, they get open, you know, the pancreatic enzymes start auto-digesting because there are areas of clogging, if you will. You know, that's one belief. It's not 100% known what that triglyceride-induced pancreatitis, what the pathophysiology is.
I can really picture that. And in particular, it's going to be the triglyceride greater than 500 milligrams per deciliter that's going to really carry that increased risk of pancreatitis. And of course, the higher those triglycerides are, the higher the risk of pancreatitis.
Yeah, and in addition to that, if you do have a patient with pancreatitis because of triglycerides, just know that their risk of organ failure and mortality is going to be higher than other common causes of pancreatitis. And once someone has had an acute pancreatitis episode, the threshold for recurrent pancreatitis can be reached at even lower thresholds of triglycerides.
Yeah, that's fascinating that even lower triglyceride levels can make someone shoot into the pancreatitis state. All right, so that's all about the risk of pancreatitis with elevated triglycerides. Let's shift gears and talk about another important organ of the body, and maybe your guys' favorite organ, the heart.
Yay, my favorite organ. I think people think, of course, triglycerides are associated with a lot of confounders like obesity, metabolic syndrome, and diabetes. Things we already know are associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So how much do triglycerides really matter?
Yeah, you know, great question. And so when we sat down with our discussants, we asked, are there other direct ways that triglycerides can make people more likely to have cardiovascular events?
It's that when the triglycerides are high, you usually require more LDL particles and more atherogenic lipoproteins to carry around the cholesterol and the triglycerides through your body. And so it's atherosclerosis risk through the traditional means. And when triglycerides are high, it usually means that LDL cholesterol is underestimating somebody's cardiovascular risk related to lipoproteins. Just think, like, if you need more particles because you have to carry around all these triglycerides, and so you need more trucks to carry the cholesterol because they're filled up with all this other stuff.
So ultimately, with a lot of triglycerides in the body, there needs to be a lot more trucks to carry them. And it's just like a traffic jam in the blood vessel causing inflammation.
There's also some evidence that triglycerides can be pro-inflammatory in and of themselves. So even though they're not part of plaque, right? So when you make a plaque, it's cholesterol, their triglycerides not in there. Well, triglyceride in the vicinity might be increasing inflammation.
So that inflammation then is the nidus for that lipid-containing junk to build up on the vessel walls. And now, when I counsel patients on cardiovascular risk, I think I'll draw up this picture of an inflammatory traffic jam.
Yeah, nice. Yes, there's so much going on there. And how can we simplify it for patients is really important. So to summarize what I'm taking away when it comes to risk of severe hypertriglyceridemia, I think I was humbled to learn how quickly triglycerides can translate shoot up after a fatty meal, alcohol. And so the next time I see a triglyceride in the triple digits, especially in that 500 range, I think I'm going to do a better job in my counseling and management, which we will cover a lot more in depth in Pearl 3 and Pearl 4. And then with the risk of the triglycerides being elevated, especially over 500 milligrams per deciliter, it's definitely associated with higher risk of acute pancreatitis.
Yeah, and it's not just the 500 threshold we care about. As a budding cardiologist, I do want to emphasize that patients who are sitting at an elevated triglyceride level above 150 to 175 do experience high cardiovascular risk that needs our attention.
Now that we talked about the risk of these triglycerides, when we do see triglycerides at a level that raises our eyebrows, we learned from our discussants we should first rule out a few things in addition to the genetics, which we'll get to in Pearl 5, and then see if we need any acute management.
So we sat down with Dr. Elliot Brinton, an endocrinologist and the president of the Utah Lipid Center in Salt Lake City.
Hypothyroidism, screen for it, treated if it's present. Proteinuria, nephrotic syndrome, is a cause of high triglycerides. Systemic glucocorticoids, of course, will cause triglycerides. So if they're taking prednisone on a daily basis, try to figure out how to deal with that if you can. Antipsychotic agents can cause both obesity and high triglycerides together. So if somebody's taking the newer antipsychotic meds, figure out a way to deal with that if you can. Maybe refer them back to their psychiatrist and see if there's something you can do.
Okay, so we would need to rule out thyroid issues, nephrotic range proteinuria, hypercortisolism, like in Cushing's disease. Is the patient on prednisone or dexamethasone, or even on an antipsychotic agent that can contribute to dyslipidemia?
Yeah. And so, of course, there will be a more exhaustive list of secondary causes in our show notes, but I'm glad we mentioned medications because that's exactly one of the things that was play in Adam's story.
And then also, actually, he had been started on Seroquel, which can have a role in triglyceride, hypertriglyceridemia-related pancreatitis. So someone did their homework in the ICU, I think, and realized that that should maybe be stopped.
So after we rule out secondary causes that might be contributing to those high triglycerides, let's just very briefly talk about acute management. And this is particularly related to severe hypertriglycerides related to pancreatitis. Ananya, you looked into this more, insulin drip, plasma exchange. What did you find?
So first things first, what we may reflexively do is make the patient NPO, and this can be really effective. It can reduce the triglycerides by up to 50% within the first 24 hours. And to really hammer this home, we learned in Pearl 1 that triglycerides rise rapidly. They can also fall pretty quickly with just making the patient NPO.
Nice context there. What about insulin drips, plasma exchange? Honestly, I've never seen these done per se, but I think it would be good to run through really quickly in case it's mentioned.
I agree. It's a bit of a gray area for me as well. When I looked, there isn't clear guidance as to who may require an insulin drip. The Endocrine Society practice guidelines really don't recommend the use of routine insulin drips for patients with severe hypertriglyceride-related pancreatitis if they don't have diabetes. Of course, if they have diabetes and they're hyperglycemic during the admission, it can definitely be offered. But of course, it does require close monitoring, Q1-hour glucose checks. And so it depends on the unit and our nursing staff and all of the factors there as well.
Definitely. And then what about plasma exchange? Is there a level of triglycerides that you might see that you're like, okay, I need to reach for this?
So not a triglyceride level per se, but usually it would be used in patients who have refractory, severe acute pancreatitis. So thinking about the patients with shock who are really not getting better. But again, this is a bit of a gray area as well. And different institutions may have different practice patterns. I will say there hasn't been much evidence supporting a direct benefit in terms of morbidity and mortality in patients with pancreatitis related to severe hypertriglycerides with plasma exchange.
That's good to know. So if we're putting this all together, it sounds like in the acute management, and I think just in general, we should always try to be ruling out secondary causes, seeing their meds, are they on a steroid? Is there an antipsychotic that could be contributing and could be switched possibly if the outpatient doctor thinks it's okay? Is there Cushing's, cortisol at play, thyroid? And then more acutely in the inpatient setting,
make this person NPO, we can really help make the triglycerides go down. It's up to, you know, 50% in the first 24 hours. And then when it comes to pancreatitis related to those triglycerides above 500 or so, an insulin drip, if the patient has diabetes, can help reduce those triglycerides. And then, yeah, if it's a really sick patient, refractory shock, you could consider plasma exchange. But when you pull that lever, when are things not getting better enough and how long do you wait? All those questions are still not clear. Okay, so after the immediate things are addressed, we then get to shift our thinking about the long-term management of these patients who have elevated triglycerides.
And of course, before we get into the medications, let's get into the most important part, in my opinion. How do we counsel these patients about their lifestyle?
Yes, definitely my favorite part. And of course, who better to talk about counseling than the wonderful Dr. Greg Katz, whose voice you might recognize from our Beyond Journal Club segment.
I talk to patients, I tell them that your triglycerides are really high. Triglycerides are concerning. It's fat in the bloodstream. It can be toxic to a bunch of organs. Your pancreas is the one that's most characteristically at risk from it. But it's also problematic because it tells us about your long-term heart disease risk in some ways. And I then will get into triglycerides are super responsive for most people to the things that we do, how much we move, what we put in our bodies. And it's also really responsive to medications. And so like, ultimately, most people need a combination of medications plus lifestyle interventions to get things under control. And so for this patient, ultimately, like we gave her a homework assignment for a week of you need to walk, you can't have a sip of alcohol, you can't have any dessert, and you need to bring me a food diary. And then we'll sort of make adjustments based on that.
Yeah. And in talking to him, I just loved hearing the stories he had of the numbers of patients he's had who had severe hypertriglyceridemia. And he really zooms into their lifestyle. For example, really recommending, you know, over 7,000 steps a day.
And so this was notable because this woman was like, I have my phone on me 100% of the time. And I looked at her step count over the last, I don't know, like month. She averaged like 900 to 1,000 steps a day. There were plenty of days where it was triple digits and she hadn't broken 1,000.
Man, there were plenty of days when I might not have even broken 1,000 steps, particularly when I was studying for STEP. I wonder how my triglycerides were doing back then.
I know, same.
And so if you take somebody who does not do any physical activity and you give them the homework of they have to go for a 20-minute walk after every meal that they have, I've had quite a few patients who have 50% reductions in their triglyceride levels from doing that. And, you know, like when you give somebody homework like that, they're probably going to be a little bit more careful about what they're eating for their diet and how long that persists and whether they do it when they don't have to see me in 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me how powerful giving patients homework can be. I think for some people, they really need that prescriptive language to make that change.
Another recommendation, of course, is to have a low-fat diet. I found it helpful to talk about this with Dr. Robert Oh, a clinical professor in family medicine at Stanford. He's run into the issue that when we recommend a low-fat diet, patients tend to fill in the gaps with refined and processed carbohydrates.
So you can go low-fat, but you have to make sure it's low saturated fat, and you have to make sure that you have higher protein and not of these refined carbohydrates, right? You have to cut the sugar out. You have to cut the alcohol off. So most people shy away from low carb for whatever reason. I think it got a bad name, but that's the one. If you look at the studies, it's looked at, there's a couple of articles and look at all the macronutrient composition. The lower carbohydrate, the better. You have a better weight loss and you have a better triglyceride profile.
So the teaching point here is that, of course, recommending both a low-fat diet and a diet that's lower in processed carbohydrates, refined carbs, and simple sugars. These excess carbs are converted by the liver into fatty acids. And of course, those fatty acids are then assembled into triglycerides and secreted as VLDL. If we really want to nerd out, we also know that high carbs can also lead to insulin resistance, which then reduces triglyceride clearance as well.
Oh man, there's so much here. And so to summarize a lifestyle counseling, what I'm taking away is really coaching patients on how responsive their triglycerides can be to lifestyle and really prescribing to them, you know, avoiding any alcohol, refined carbs, sugar, a low-fat diet, you know, as much aerobic exercise as they can get, weight loss. And the idea of tracking can be really helpful. and having them come back on the sooner side. All right. So in addition to counseling on lifestyle, we also need to talk about medications. For example, Adam's patient, you know, hit that patient's triglyceride was still sitting at 388, even at a fasting level, a few days into the hospitalization and mostly being NPO. And again, I like have to remember that idea that, you know, just one fatty meal in this patient could saturate his lipoprotein lipase right above 500 or so threshold and hopefully not set him back into pancreatitis.
Yeah, that's such an important point. Well, before we get into meds, though, in this initial visit, it may be a solid for a future you to get a fasting triglyceride level. And Dr. Brinton touches a little bit on this.
I always prefer fasting. And the reason is it has less noise. Triglycerides fasted or fed are going to vary by 20 to 30 to 40 to 50%. And if you think about that for a minute, our triglyceride-lowering drugs have efficacy in that same range. So you've got a problem with signal to noise where the signal and the noise are in the same range. So how can you figure out if somebody's getting better or worse on a given medication if one time you measure them fasting and the next time non-fasting, or if you measure them twice non-fasting and in one time it's been, say, 6 hours and they had very little fat, or the second time it's been 2 hours and they had a lot of fat. In either case, you're going to have a huge difference in terms of kind of microns.
And yes, different people can have different practices with having patients come back for a fasting lipid panel. It's an extra blood stick. Some people want to see what their non-fasting triglyceride lives at. But when the triglycerides are getting into that severe range and you're thinking about starting a medication, getting a fasting one really definitely helps to see the impact of that medication without too much noise, whether or not they have banana chips or some Ben and Jerry's before getting abs.
Definitely had some Ben and Jerry's in the waiting room. But yes, I love all the tips to help future you interpret the impact of medications. All right, so when it comes to medications, what do we got on the table and how much does it really help?
There are three big buckets we're going to talk about: statins, omega-3s, and fibrates. And maybe let's start with the most familiar one to a lot of us, statins.
How do we prevent ASCVD in our patients with high triglycerides? Well, believe it or not, what we're going to do is use a statin. Now you go, wait a minute, statins lower LDL, they don't lower triglycerides. Well, in a person with normal triglycerides, whatever their percent LDL lowering is about half as good for triglycerides. So you're using a high-intensity statin, you get a 50 to 60% LDL lowering, you're going to have a 25 to 30% triglyceride reduction. Now, it doesn't mean that triglyceride lowering goes down a lot more, but what it means is that you're going to get as much triglyceride reduction as you do LDL lowering.
So in general with statins, we can expect patients to drop their triglycerides by 10 to 30%, but at higher levels, we can have an even greater degree of reduction.
Awesome. And just to say it out loud, the 2018 AHA AEC cholesterol management guidelines do say start a statin if your patient is between 40 and 75 years old and has persistent, moderately elevated triglycerides. So that's a fasting triglyceride greater than 175 to 499 milligrams per deciliter. Or if they have severe hypertriglycerides, so that's greater than 500 milligrams per deciliter with a 10-year ASCVD greater than 7.5%. And the reasoning here is, yes, you get a little bit of triglyceride lowering, but more so it's about decreasing their overall cardiovascular risk at these states.
Right. So let's talk about other options as well, because in addition to that ASCVD risk reduction, those patients who have really high triglycerides in the triple digits, especially greater than 500 milligrams per deciliter, are going to need more than just a statin. So another option is fenofibrate.
Fenofibrate is probably the medication that has the largest evidence base that it lowers triglyceride levels. And anecdotally, it just seems really effective at lowering triglyceride levels.
And looking at the evidence, you can actually expect a 30 to 50% reduction in triglycerides when you start fenofibrate.
Sounds good. All right, tell me about omega-3s. I mean, my dad takes fish oil supplements because of some random WhatsApp video that was sent to him. And I don't know, maybe that's helping since it was one of the three that you mentioned.
Omega-3 fatty acids also do a really good job of lowering triglyceride levels. It's related to how they impact lipoprotein lipase. And that's a very easy add-on. And if you look at like the whole premise behind Reduce It, which was the trial adding VASCEPA to standard of care lipid lowering therapy, was that it helped to clear the triglycerides and it helped to treat these patients who had residual triglyceride risk.
So Reduce It was a pretty large trial. These are patients with type 2 diabetes. or other cardiovascular risk factors, and they already were on a statin, which is super important to understand, and they had triglyceride levels above 150. So that was kind of the inclusion criteria. And so these are high-risk patients already on a statin, and their triglyceride levels are up, and then they offered them in randomized fashion 4 grams of cosepin ethyl, or Vascepa. The number needed to treat was 111. So one person, 111 person treated and have one cardiovascular or mortality benefit, which is pretty decent, decent numbers, considering they're already on a statin already.
So that's a huge finding, that omega-3 supplementation had a 25% reduction in major cardiovascular events. And for those like me who like numbers, these omega-3s can lead to about a 28% triglyceride reduction when you get to those doses of 3 to 4 grams of EPA or eicosapentaenoic acid per day.
Cool. And with these omega-3s, one association to possibly keep in mind is that they did find increased rates or hospitalizations for atrial fibrillation in the omega-3 group. And this might be something to watch out for, especially in patients who may have poor cardiac substrate.
Yeah, that's definitely something to be cautious about. I'm also wondering if patient, or like in the case of Shreya's dad, is over-the-counter fish oil sufficient? Or should we be transitioning everybody to a prescription strength? Of course, if it's covered by insurance and affordable for the patient.
So what about the dietary supplement omega-3? It's cheap, it's easy, it's there in the grocery store. Pick up a giant bottle of it and start taking it. Well, there are several problems. Number one, they tend to have a lot of saturated fat. Number two, they tend to be oxidized. Number three, they basically always have a lot of DHA. So you're digging the hole deeper. So please tell your patients, please never recommend dietary supplement omega-3. And please tell your patients if they're taking them to stop, because it's not helping them.
So the omega-3 supplements that patients can get over the counter actually have a variable amount of EPA and DHA. And so you're not sure exactly how much a patient might be getting. And then just for context, that REDUCE-IT trial, the omega-3 used, it was prescription strength omega-3 purified EPA and no DHA.
So I also want to bring up some really recent evidence hot off the press. There was an RCT that showed that prescription strength omega-3s in patients on hemodialysis reduced MACE by about 43%. So in this trial, there wasn't really a baseline elevation in triglycerides for the patients on hemodialysis. So theoretically, the reduction in MACE may have been through a mechanism that was separate from triglyceride lowering.
Nice. Yeah. And interestingly, in the fine print, if you look, it was a combo prescription in like a 2-to-1 ratio between EPA and DHA. So maybe we need to have more EPA for it to be effective. I think either way, the takeaway is when you're doing your med rec to make sure it's not patients who are just, you know, buying omega-3s off the shelves. It sounds like the doses of EPA and DHA can be so variable, and that we are prescribing the omega-3 that is, you know, whichever one, whether it's the purified EPA or the one that's higher in EPA content.
Definitely. Yeah. I think the prescription is really the only way to ensure this. Also, just wanted to bring up niacin. I think a lot of us learn about it in medical school as a part of the triglyceride treatment pathway. But really, in practicality, it's not in our toolkit, even for severe hypertriglyceridemia. Not many people can really tolerate the medication, especially with the side effect of flushing, and it can also cause liver injury. And there also hasn't been a clear cardiovascular benefit.
Yeah, so it sounds like we really have the statins, the phenofibrates, and the omega-3s to choose from. And so that brings us to a very important point, which is how do we choose, right? Is it side effect driven? What really helps us decide to start this one versus that one?
Yeah, so it's a question that comes up all the time in our clinic visits. And we really press our discussants on this. And honestly, most of them says start with the medications that you are most comfortable with.
And another point is that if you want to rapidly lower triglycerides, so for those patients who are at risk for pancreatitis, especially with the levels over 500, reach for the phenofibrates and omega-3. These medications are better for rapidly lowering the triglycerides and can give as much as a 50% reduction.
Awesome. And even the ADA, the American Diabetes Association, has an explicit recommendation for anyone with a fasting triglyceride greater than 500 to, you know, really reach for a phenofibrate or a high dose omega-3 fatty acid. And that's really warranted to reduce that pancreatitis risk.
And then there's, of course, statins, which have less of an impressive triglyceride lowering footprint in terms of percent reduction, but do have that ASCVD benefit. And now we see that omega-3s also have that.
Perfect. And so we talked about the importance of medications. once our patients are on these medications, the other questions in clinic is when to bring a patient back and what to check in on during these visits.
So I tend to bring them back more frequently, more rapidly. So 4 to 6 weeks, let's say. So that's what I would do. So you're looking for, frankly, dramatic changes in those comorbidities. Is the patient doing something to lose weight? Has the patient started exercising? Is the diet better? Has the patient cut back on alcohol? Any medications that they were on that increased triglycerides, have they been changed? You know, things like that. So you're looking to see that there's been a significant change that would ultimately lead to a sustained reduction in triglycerides, not just the blood test that you're repeating.
That was good spaced repetition to what we talked about earlier in the podcast about all the things that may be contributing to that triglyceride level.
So if we were to summarize the three typical medications we're reaching for when it comes to triglycerides, there is one more that we'll cover in Pearl 5. It's really an art, right, in terms of which ones to start and how many do you start at once, depending on how the triglycerides are and how motivated that patient is in terms of lifestyle. But the ones that have an ASCVD reduction is going to be our statins. And now more data is coming out about the omega-3, and it's in particular the prescription strength omega-3s, higher doses, 3 to 4 grams a day, and with more EPA content. And then the ones that rapidly lower the triglycerides, especially when we are worried about the risk of pancreatitis, phenylfibrates usually first line, then you can also reach for omega-3s too. All right. So most of these cases with high triglycerides are associated with metabolic syndrome, alcohol use, other things. But as Greg mentioned, everyone does have different genetics at play. Yeah. So the reason to watch out for these different genetics at play is because the treatment is completely different for some of the genetic syndromes. There are two big buckets. The first we call FCS, for familial chylomicronemia syndrome. The other form is MCS, the metabolic form, and that we call mixed chylomicronemia syndrome. They can be a mouthful, but Dr. Seth Baum and Dr. Elliot Brinton takes us through this beautifully.
In FCS, first of all, it's an ultra-rare disorder, right? It's present somewhere between 1 and, let's say, 10 people per million to 2. FCS has certain classic patterns of presentation, classic findings. They are not necessary, though, to make the diagnosis, right? So you can be off on one or two of these things and still have FCS. So it's a monogenic disorder. There are 5 genes that are typically involved. It's a biallelic mutation. So one mutation from mom, one from dad.
It is most often a defect in the lipoprotein lipase gene, LPL, that reduces its activity. In fact, generally, these people have, you know, 0 to 20% of normal lipoprotein lipase activity. So FCS means what? You generally have chylomicronemia since you were very young. It often presents in neonates or young children or preteens or teenagers.
Yes. People with FCS have a genetically determined low activity of lipoprotein lipase. When you don't have as much lipoprotein lipase, you lose your ability to break down chylomicrons. So people with FCS present with sky-high triglycerides that are persistent regardless of fasting or not.
If you do genetics on a patient and the patient does not have the evidence of those mutations, it does not mean that the patient doesn't have FCS, right? If you find them, the patient has it. If you don't find them, you still have to consider the diagnosis.
So it turns out genetic tests miss a certain number of people who behave like FCS but do not have a detectable mutation with our genetic panels.
Yeah, and hold that thought about genotype versus phenotype. We'll come back to that in a second. Let's talk about the other genetics at play, the MCS patients. And just to be clear, this is technically patients whose fasting triglycerides greater than 880. And this is the observed kind of tipping point where we see chylomicrons developing in the blood.
For every case that you see, there's probably 500 cases of it's just metabolic syndrome, and it's just elevated triglycerides related to an imbalance between somebody's lifestyle and what their genetics want their lifestyle to be.
So it sounds like MCS is much more common and makes me wonder, when we are evaluating a patient in clinic, can we just, you know, most likely they're going to be MCS, or is there something else we're looking for when those triglycerides are over 80 to make us suspect, okay, this is FCS versus MCS?
So phenotype always trumps genotype. Okay. So that's one thing you think about. You look at the individual and there are certain things you go look for. What's the age of onset? Well, you know, when I was 30 years old, I was told I had a very high triglyceride. So it's young. It's not terribly young, but it's young. That favors FCS over MCS. Patient's body habits. Is the patient overweight or obese? If the patient's overweight or obese, favors MCS. FCS, typically thinner. You look at whether or not the patient has any secondary causes of severe hypertriglyceridemia. Diabetes would be the typical one. Metabolic syndrome, central obesity, you know, other like underlying rheumatologic disorders or medications that might cause it, hormonal medications, atypical antipsychotics. So you go through this list and you go, does the patient have any of these features? You ask about things like abdominal discomfort. Do you have periodic abdominal discomfort? Because that could be a sign that there's like a low-grade pancreatitis, if you will, or are there cognitive disorders? Do you feel like you're in a foggy state frequently? Do you miss a lot of work? Those favor FCS, okay? What were prior triglyceride levels, if you have access to them? If they were all over 1,000 and the patient doesn't have any of these other causes that would be associated with MCS, you're really looking at an FCS patient. What about response to triglyceride-lowering therapeutics? So you say, have you ever been given a fibrate or, you know, a statin for triglyceride lowering or omega-3 fatty acids? Yeah, I have. They didn't work at all. Start favoring FCS over MCS. They're variable in MCS, though, so you still might have a poor response.
These are all very important clues that help us identify patients with FCS. And this brings us to an important question. So why do we want to identify FCS? The presence of FCS has significant implications for treatment. FCS tends to not respond well to traditional lipid-lowering therapies like statins and fibrates and omega-3s because often these therapies require working lipoprotein lipase. And for a very long time, patients with FCS really didn't have much therapeutic options except for a very low-fat diet for a lifetime. But now we have some good news.
December of 2024, finally, the FDA approved the first drug for FCS, and that's olezarsen. It's an antisense oligonucleotide that blocks APOC3 production. On FCS, you get only a 50% triglyceride lowering. Well, that's a miracle for an FCS patient because there they have so few treatment options. And that's enough to reduce pancreatitis by roughly 80 to 90%. And that is amazing.
And I think that brings us to our most relevant question when it comes to genetics. If we do have a patient in clinic whose triglycerides greater than 500, do we send off genetic testing?
One other thing I will say, I do not bother to genotype patients who have persistent chylomicronemia and or either the clinical functional FCS or what would ultimately be proven to be genotypic FCS. Why? Because the label does not require it. FDA does not require this for use of these very expensive APOC3 drugs. And a majority of patients who have what looks like typical FCS have this clinical or functional FCS and not genotypic. So in a majority of cases, you will, quote, prove yourself wrong by failing to genotype them as FCS.
So for the most part, our discussants had mixed practices for sending off genotyping. Some say it can get expensive for patients. But Dr. Baum did say that he would send off genetic testing for FCS if the phenotype fits because it may have implications for familial screening.
Exactly. And with that, we will end with one final word from Dr. Seth Baum.
I would say that I think we need to look at triglycerides differently nowadays, that we need to have in the SHTG population, we need to have a sense of urgency where previously we didn't have that. And it's for a couple of reasons. One, it's for the acute pancreatitis risk, and especially in view of the saturation of lipoprotein lipase at around triglyceride of around 500. These people are at much higher risk than you think they are for acute pancreatitis. And the other is ASCVD. I mean, it's still the leading cause of death in the United States. And I think, you know, anything we can do to diminish the risk would be valuable. So that would be it, you know, pay attention, take it seriously, and do what you can to reduce it.
All right. And that is a wrap for our episode today. If you got some value from this podcast, our ask is to please send it to one other colleague who could also use a nice aha moment. I know I had a bunch myself.
Same here. And thank you so much to our peer reviewers, Dr. Zahid Ahmad and Dr. Michael Shapiro. Thank you to Dr. Nabil Swice for the accompanying graphic.
And as always, we love hearing feedback. Please email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you and take care.
Is there a triglyceride? Why is triglyceride so hard to say today?
I don't know.
Is there a triglyceride?
I'm having trouble too, like all the R's. And
yeah.
The holidays are sneaking up fast, and I've got to say, I love Uncommon Goods. As the name suggests, it's full of one-of-a-kind gifts you won't find anywhere else. For example, I've definitely gotten stuck years before on things to get my nieces or nephews. It feels like they have everything, right? But Uncommon Goods has things that are truly different, thoughtful, high quality, handmade often, made right here in the U.S. And there's something for everyone, moms, dads, teens, foodies, aka all my cousins, even gardening stuff for my dad. So I found so many fun personal ideas I haven't seen before. And if you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're not just checking something off a list, you're also supporting artists, small independent businesses, and many of their products are made in small batches. So if something catches your eyes, definitely scoop it up before it sells out. And I love this. With every purchase, they donate $1 to any nonprofit partner of your choice. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/coreim. That's uncommongoods.com/coreim to get 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited offer. And as they say, Uncommon Goods, because we're all out of the ordinary. And now back to the episode.